I try to make sure she's exposed to as much as possible. And she's still trying to figure out what it is that she wants to do. She believes right now that she wants to be an entrepreneur. She doesn't know what type of entrepreneur, but she knows that the traditional going to work for someone else is not for her. So I'm working on, even now, right, there's certain things that build her character and expand on her mindset that I get her involved with. Like, one of the cool things that we did last summer was she was able to be a camp counselor.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Borderless Odeshi podcast. I have Garth Robinson with me today in the studio. Welcome to the podcast, Garth.
Thanks for the invite, Mike. Pleasure to be here and looking forward to this conversation, learning more about each other.
Absolutely. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, man. It's been a really chill day. Got a few things done, including first run this morning, played some ball, nice. Won some games.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a good way to start the day.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, you know, what you do, so people can get to know you, I can get to know you, and then we can start getting started on the conversations.
Yeah, so I'm originally from Jamaica. I was born in Portmore, specifically. And I was raised there till about, I want to say it's between 6-8. Had a nuclear family. My mom eventually came to the States so that she can get things going. And during that time, it was really my dad who was raising us. So it was me, my older brother, 2 years older, and then my sister. She was in and out the house because she went to boarding school for the most part. So one day we came home, and I mean, Jamaica was awesome, right? And just being a kid, you don't necessarily know any better. The standard of living, it wasn't great compared to how we live now or what we've known to, right? Yeah. Like, my dad was doing well. He was an accountant for the rum company, the major rum company, Ray and Nephew.
Wow.
And he also ran the union for the rum company. And these are things that I came to find out over the years. But he ran the union for the rum company, and we were well-to-do. My mom in the States, I don't know exactly what their situation was at that time, but all I knew is that my dad was raising us, and then my mom would send barrels. I don't know if you're familiar with the barrels.
For sure. She would send, like, clothes and shoes and snacks.
Everything that you want. You know, when you go to the States, you want to just buy everything.
Everything,
right?
Everything has to go.
So she would send back the barrels, and we didn't see her for a few years. So one day my dad comes home and he's like, hey, we're going to go to my uncle's wedding in the U.S. So the crazy thing about this is my uncle, he was a ladies man. He still is for the most part. But there was this woman. So in the house, it was me, my dad, my uncle, my older brother, and my sister, like I said, was at boarding school. So my uncle, younger than my dad, he would be the one to watch us whenever my dad's at work and all that and all those type of things. So me and my brother, being bad kids, we saw the neighbors just moving in, and the neighbor had a younger kid about our age that was living there. And we started battling with this kid, and we were just bad, like throwing rocks directly across the house, directly in front of us. So the next morning you go and you see it's like a cobblestone on these people's porch.
It's crazy.
And my uncle just knew we did it. Right. So he goes over there. We had to clean up all the stuff, and he ends up apologizing. And then from there, that turns into a budding relationship with this woman and my uncle. So they start dating. So fast forward a few years later, my dad comes back. He's like, yo, you know, my uncle went to the States and he's now with this woman because she also had a family in the States and they're living together. And he's like, yo, Uncle Peter's getting married. I was like, oh, that's what's up. Uncle Peter's getting married. So we go and we go, we're having a great time. And I remember that wedding vividly, right? Where we're having a great time as young kids.
Just turning up.
just turning up, having a great time. Then when it was time to go, my dad, he was like, hey, I'm going to go home, but you guys are going to stay here. So I stayed with the aunt in New York.
Okay, so your dad came back, went back to Jamaica, but you guys stayed back in, in the U.S.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah. Okay. So he was like, hey, like I got to go back to finish setting things up. He was like, but I'm going to leave you guys here so that we can start to work towards moving here.
Okay.
So I grew up with an aunt in New York, my brother with another aunt in Virginia, and then my sister, when she finally came to the States, she grew up with an aunt in Philadelphia.
Was that a part of the plan when you guys left Jamaica that we're all going, but you guys are staying back, or was it just a thing of no need to pack your bags, you staying?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is it wasn't a part of the plan. When we initially left, we got on the flight and we hit the States. But at some point during that time, because my dad was the head of the union, he ended up losing his job. So when he lost his job, he started talking to his siblings about it. And they were just like, well, you know, the move has always been, we want to come to the U.S. one day. And this just seems like, while you figure out things back there so that you can eventually come here, just leave the kids here, and then we can move on.
Interesting. Interesting. Do you know what your dad did for the union exactly? Do you know what his job was?
You know, I don't know the detail, but I know he was the main person. He was the speaker for the union. He negotiated labor, like the labor rate and those type of things, right?
Okay.
Making sure that people are treated fairly and getting paid fairly, right?
For the time. Like a workers' union.
Workers' union, was doing that type of stuff. So, I mean,
that's dope.
It was really surprising to me to come to find out.
Why was it surprising? You didn't see your dad as someone who would do that type of work, or was he quiet?
He's not quiet when you talk to him, right? But he's also not one of these people who's in front of your face. Like, my uncle's one of those people where he's in front of your face, but my dad has always been reserved. So to find out that he was actually the voice of the people that worked for that job, it was really surprising.
And that's huge. And you said that's the largest legal.
It's the liquor company in Jamaica. Wow. Yeah, wow. The liquor company.
That's
yeah.
dope. What's the name again?
Ray and Nephew. W-R-A-Y and Nephew.
Okay, so I think I have tried Ray and Nephew in the Bronx, New York.
Yeah, that's where all the Caribbeans are.
Yeah. I think I have. But I'll check it out again.
Especially the white rum.
Yeah, okay. So going back to your mom being in the U.S., you being raised by your dad. See, I was raised by my dad as well, and because my mom and dad separated when I was 10, 11, and it was just me, my dad, and my elder brother at home. But he was almost never at home, because, you know. How was that like for you when it comes to, like, attention and him being there for you guys? Or was it just a thing of your boys raise yourself? Because for me, that's what happened when my mom left.
Yeah, I mean, we were fairly well off, right? To the point where we had a nanny. So, and he had a lot of friends. He had a lot of friends, plus my uncle, who was active in our lives, right? Mm-hmm. And my dad is very social, so he made it, like, he made friends with the teachers. So he would be working, and we would be at home with this nanny for the most part. So it wasn't like we lacked anything that we truly needed. I wouldn't say that he was also young, right? Like, that the cool thing is I am now a parent, right? And I see the transition.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you also want your free time, right? Yeah. Your kids want you, but you also want your free time. So we were in that space where he was fairly young, so he was still actively partying and doing those type. You know, Jamaicans love to party. So he was actively partying and doing those type of things. So he would be home. He would help us with our homework. The nanny would also help us with our homework. My dad would more or less check it. And that was really it, right? He was definitely the disciplinarian. I was the youngest. I didn't really get in any beatings like that.
I'll have to check in with Mike to to fact check that.
Oh yeah, I mean, he'll definitely confirm. He definitely got some beatings. I got away with a lot of stuff.
Okay, so did you see your mom when you came for the wedding in New York?
No. Actually, I want to say, yeah, I did, but it may have been like once or so. So the dynamic is interesting, right? Where at some point they broke up, and being raised by my dad's side of the family, they wouldn't allow my mom to see us at all. Like, my mom was in New York. And there was one point where she couldn't even come in the house.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that was, now looking back, and then, like, definitely you don't do that type of stuff to kids. It was sort of weird. But she made sure that we had everything that we needed, right? Whether or not she was seeing us. Yeah. We had all the clothes we can ask for. We always had money. She was a nurse here. She's still a nurse. Like, she made sure that we had, like, the cool thing was, or one of the cool things was, like, she made sure that we had all the J's before they came out. I don't know how she got the hookup on that, but there was this spot that was around the corner from her called Bob's Sneaker Corner, and she would pay an extra $50, $100.
Just to make sure
we had the shoes at least a week before it came out.
Damn.
So while she wasn't not any fault of her own, while she wasn't immediately present, she tried her best to be present financially and that type of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's dope. I think that's dope. You know, it's hard with family dynamics, honestly, when mom and dad go their separate way and there's a kid involved. It's always complicated. If the mom has the kids, doesn't want the dad to see the kids. If the dad has the kids, doesn't want the mom to see the kids. So sometimes it's the families. But it takes a toll. It takes a toll on the kid that, I don't know if our parents do consider, like, how would this be affecting the kid if I let the mom not see them, or I let the dad not see them, or do they just do it because, you know, I don't like this woman anymore, I don't like this man anymore, so I don't want them associated with my kids anymore. It's very complicated. We see that happening almost everywhere, if not everywhere in the world today. The solution, who knows? Probably just the human thing. It's human nature. You know, but now you're a parent, you have a kid as well. And are you, like, what are you doing in your own family, in your own small family you have today, that, you know, would raise, like, to create a healthy family for you, your wife, and your kid?
Yeah, no, I mean, just given the situation that I grew up in, I make sure that I'm conscious of it, right? So me and her mom, we aren't together anymore. And we met in undergrad and dated off and on after, and it eventually fizzled out, right? And once we decided that we weren't going to be together anymore because of the way that I was raised, I was like, hey, look, she was from the Virginia Beach area, Newport News. She eventually moved to the D.C. area so that we can switch every week. So it's been one of those things where ever since we broke up, it's always been like clockwork. At one point, it was Sundays, we were meeting, and then it switched to Mondays, which made things easier for everybody because you pick her up right after school on your day of transition.
Okay.
So I make sure that I dedicate time to her, right? Like we read together. We go grab either lunch or dinner together, more than likely ice cream. And then we talk during that time. And then like one of the things that we developed over time was like watching movies. So scary movies is our thing. I remember when she was like 3 years old. When she was like 3 years old and, not The Exorcist. What is it called? The one with Annabelle.
I think it's Annabelle.
Yeah, she was like 3 years old and we were watching Annabelle together. And really from that, like she developed a liking for watching scary movies, but more importantly, it became our thing, yeah, right? Where we watch scary movies together. Yeah.
That's dope. Yeah. So spending more time and just giving her the attention, I think that's good. And you know, you said something earlier about you being aware of the conditions and environment you were raised in, and I think that's the first step. Because a lot of people do not become aware of that. They just keep on moving on, making the same mistakes. And they're never aware that, oh, I'm doing the same things my parent did and I should be doing something different to create a different environment. 9 out of 10 times, they say hurt people hurt people. Yeah. And 9 out of 10 times, if I just keep doing the same thing, you know, my parents did just because, oh, you know, it's our culture. This is how I was raised. And I'll keep on doing the same mistake to my kids and they'll keep on leaving that same pattern for generations to come. So I think that's a huge step. You know, leaving Jamaica, moving to New York, you mentioned D.C. So you've actually lived in different places, different states, different countries. How has that shaped your communication, skills, patterns, and just your ideology about the world that we live in?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've always been fairly reserved in to myself, right? Like I've always tried to, I was always the person that was probably doing a bad thing, but no one realized that it was me because I've always been the quiet, like chill person.
No one suspects God.
So in New York, there was nothing but Caribbean people. So when you go there, it's nothing but Caribbean people mixed in with African American people, and then you have, well, in the part that I grew up in, and the Jamaica Queens, and then you have some other minorities there, right? Like you have, including like Indian Caribbeans. Mm-hmm. Didn't necessarily interface a lot with any Caucasians or anything like that outside of that. So, like, it was heavy, just Caribbeans and just about everybody that looked like me. So I went from one space where it was completely me, people who looked like me in Jamaica, and I transitioned to New York, where it's, like, people who still look like me, they talk like me, and, I mean, literally talk like the patois and all that type of stuff. Like, they spoke like me, and there was a sprinkle of white people, right? So then I transitioned from there to Long Island, where now you start to see predominantly white, right? Where at the majority of the people, they no longer look like me, but the people within the neighborhood that I lived in, they still look like me. They don't necessarily speak like me, but they still look like me, and there was a common bond there.
Interesting.
So as I went through high school, you know, navigating that, high school was great. I loved high school, and I had a good group of friends and, you know, being straightforward, they all looked like me. They were all African-American. You hear their story for the most part, and it has the same background. So then from there, I used to visit my older brother at Virginia Tech. So
from New York?
From New York. So, well, let me backtrack. In the summertime, when I was in New York, I would go visit my older brother in Virginia, Northern Virginia, Arlington. And we would have a great time. So eventually, by the time that he went to college, he's like, hey, come check this out. Like, this is what the next step looks like. Because one of the things that my parents and my aunts, uncles, everyone who had a hand in raising us, they're like, the utmost important thing is education. Before I even knew what college was, I knew I had to go.
A typical immigrant story.
Yeah, it's like, you got to be a doctor or yep. some sort of businessman.
Yep.
But I knew I had to go to college. So seeing my older brother go to college, and now that's broadening my perspective, this beautiful campus in the mountains, rural, you know, there's cows, all those things.
How old were you at that time?
I was probably like 15.
Okay.
Yeah, so like 15, New York, like city of New York, yeah. Going to rural, middle of nowhere, Virginia. They got cows, they got, can I say rednecks over here?
Yeah.
And everything revolves around this college town and this football team centered school. Right? So
interesting.
And you see people the first few times when I went there, my brother and his friends, they would just take us, me and my other cousin, take us to the parties and that type of stuff. 15 in the parties. So we'd be in the parties, hanging out, all those things. It's like, oh, okay. I'm starting to get an idea what college is like, the freedom. You're walking the campus and you're seeing where you're fending for yourself. You also have an obligation to make sure that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, yeah.
But my brother, he wasn't necessarily doing what he was supposed to be doing, man. He's a very smart guy. But at that point in his life, he was just like party, party, party. So when it came to my time to go to school, like my grades weren't great. They were okay. They were well enough. And I still, to some extent, thought I was going to be a basketball player. at 5'8". So at any rate, I end up going to a 5'9". I end up going to Virginia State with some of my other brother's friends. And Virginia State was crazy. Actually, one of my boys from high school also went to Virginia State, and he went on a football scholarship.
Nice.
So Virginia State was crazy because it's a HBCU, historically black college. So I get there and it's nothing but people that look like me. I'm like, oh, this is love, right? So then when you start to really settle and you see what's going on at Virginia State, the campus, it's supposedly secure, but it's not, right? There's this clash between New Yorkers and DC people, and Richmond is somewhere in there.
That's wild.
So people were getting killed.
For real?
Yeah, people were getting killed. And on the campus, like, students were actively being killed. Like,
man.
You talk to people and they'd be like, oh, Virginia State is great. They have all these beautiful women, all that, and which they did. they definitely did. But then from a safety standpoint, it's like you don't go from one project to go to a secure space where you think that nothing like this is supposed to happen. Yeah. And you see people active and you hear people actively getting killed, right? You're getting messages from the main office or whatever that, hey, so-and-so was murdered last night and and this is an ongoing investigation. Like one of the, I mean, I don't even want to talk about that story, but so my boy that went to school with us, right? Again, it's the same thing. New York, D.C., Richmond. Like people will all look alike, butting their heads over God knows what. So one of my boy that I ended up going there with, he's like, yo, I'm getting the fuck out of here. And it was like a group of New Yorkers who was like, yo, I'm getting the fuck out of here. So my boy, first semester, like we all ended up making sure that we got our grades right. And first semester, he transferred back to New York, CW Post, so that he can play football. He's actually doing very well today. Then the other group of friends, they transferred at the end of the year with me. And the conversation was, are we going to go to Hampton? They, like, all of us were looking at going to Hampton. And then I was looking at going to Virginia Tech. So I went back and forth with that for a while. And while Hampton was different in the fact that it seemed secure and it's one of the higher rated HBCUs, I was just like, look, I've experienced this shit before. I'm not doing that again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I ended up going to Virginia Tech with my older brother. So while I was at Tech, I ended up doing the same thing. Like I was partying and having a good time. And got my degree and got out of there. But it was certainly different because it gave me a perspective that I didn't have before.
Yeah.
Right? Because I'm around a group of people who all think the same. And the reason why they think the same is because this is all they know.
Yeah.
So I experienced that in New York. I experienced that in Virginia State. And then when I got to Blacksburg, where Virginia Tech was, everyone isn't thinking the same because everyone has a different background and more diverse, right? It's a more diverse cultural, socioeconomic backgrounds, right? So you start having different conversations, which then expand your thought process. So I'm no longer the person that I was, 4 years ago, just because I now, or better yet, not even 2-3 years ago from when I left Virginia State, because I'm no longer in that sphere. Sure, cool. Right. Yeah. So yeah, no, I mean, Blacksburg was definitely good for me. And I've already had the conversation with my daughter, make sure that she goes to school somewhere outside of D.C., so that she can get that perspective as well.
Yeah. I think that's key. I think that's key. First of all, I mean, situation in Virginia State is it Virginia State?
Virginia State.
Yeah. I mean, that's horrible. That's horrible. You know, you can try to prevent these things, but if students decide that, you know, I belong to this clique, I'm repping this city and I'm repping this city and this is what we're gonna do, it's hard to cool those situations down. I mean, you can expel whoever you want to expel, but if sometimes those affiliations run so deep that you can expel 10 people from either side and it will still go on. So I feel like just moving schools was the best way to just avoid any situation personally for you coming out of that.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
Are you talking to your daughter about what she wants to do? Like, does she has any idea?
Yeah. I try to make sure she's exposed to as much as possible. And she's still trying to figure out what it is that she wants to do. She believes right now that she wants to be an entrepreneur. She doesn't know what type of entrepreneur, but she knows that the traditional going to work for someone else is not for her.
Yeah.
So I'm working on, even now, right, there's certain things that build her character and expand on her mindset that I get her involved with. Like, one of the cool things that we did last summer was she was able to be a camp counselor. She wasn't of the age to be a camp counselor, but because we have a family member who owns a camp, she was able to experience that, learn how to guide the young kids and also talking with her peers.
Yeah, that's dope.
So she's like, yo, I hate kids. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool, right? At least you know you don't want to deal with kids. And she's like, yo, I don't want to be a teacher. I was like, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Then what's the next thing? And it's just like trying out different things until we figure out what hits.
What she wants to do.
Yeah.
That's dope. How wanting to become an entrepreneur, do you think she is learning or she got that from you? Because, you know, again, let's just dive into what do you do? And then we can move on to that question.
Yeah, in short, I'm a real estate developer, right? Real estate developer and investor. So I own small multifamily throughout the D.C. area. I've also done some syndications outside the D.C. area. And I'm looking to expand on my portfolio, specifically within D.C., if it's four units, because I know that business model in and out. Outside of D.C., I'm looking to expand up to 15 units, and then from there, continuously build on the per unit count. And I've been doing that now for about, I want to say, 15 years, right? I had a good friend at the time when it had to be about maybe 12, 13 years or so, because it was right when I had my daughter at the time. And my friend, she always knew that I wanted to work for myself, and I was trying to figure out how to scale and like build over time, gradually get into that real estate space. And she introduced me to this program that where you can find homes online, the HUD Home Store. You find these foreclosed homes. You buy them, you fix them up. You're getting them at a discounted price. And then you put a decent amount, it wasn't even a lot of money into it. And from there, I really started to get the business model of how to scale it from there. So to answer your initial question, yeah, I do believe she sees the way I operate. Like the majority of, so my brother is also an entrepreneur. So everyone that she's around is active entrepreneurs and all doing their own thing. My sister is also an entrepreneur. So she sees what it could afford you as long as you're able to figure out what it is that you want to do, dedicate yourself to your craft and build on your craft.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What have you always wanted to be an entrepreneur personally for you? Or is this something you thought about down the line? Like, when did that spark emerge for you?
Yeah, I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. Like, I remember being in high school where there was a point where I was selling candy to other kids. Right? And I'd buy a candy bag. I'd buy a bunch of candy for $5, sell it. And at the end of the day, I'd have 20. Rinse, repeat, and continuously do that. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
Sort of like her, I didn't know what form it would be in. And then over time, there was just something about buildings that I've always loved. The crazy thing, one of my good friends that also transferred from Virginia State, he told me he ran into one of our other boys from Virginia State. And this was like, I want to say it was last year, he told me. And he was like, yo, is this person was like, yo, is G still doing or trying to do real estate? So it's like, to think about it when it was like 14 years
right.
of, I've always known that's the space that I wanted to be in.
Yeah.
But it's just how I'm going to do it was always the part I've worked on figuring out. Yeah.
That's dope. So what's the plan for you? I know you say you want to expand, but what's the plan? Like, do you have a number of, you know, units you're going to get to where you're like, okay, I'm just going to manage these, or are you always going to try to, like, move on to the next unit?
Yeah,
like, do you have a number in mind?
I don't have a number in mind. I'm trying to acquire one small multifamily in a year, and that's the 4-unit. Trying to work on one development a year, and then looking to acquire that 10 to 15 units. So if I can do 3 of those a year over time, however that shapes up, of course, it's not always going to hit off like that, where maybe it may be one of those, right?
Yeah.
And then the next year is the next one. But over time, just gradually build my portfolio that way.
How do you find tenants? Do you have a website? Do you have, like, how do you get people, you know, to come? Do you have a property management company helping you out? How do you manage all of these?
I manage them all myself. So, and at one point, I did have a property management company that were horrible. But I won't even get into them because I hired them, in all honesty, for the wrong reasons, right? So I hired them because I thought this was going to be another black company who's looking to also grow, but they didn't have the right procedures, practices in place, structure, that type of thing. And they were more so concerned with the leasing, because once they lease, regardless of the shitty tenants that they put in there, they get their commission. And then they'll get their monthly commission from when the rent is paid. Mm. In most cases, with the ones that they put in there, and it wasn't paid. So I look for tenants on, I've used Zillow, I've used apartments.com, word of mouth. One of the things that I do believe in, because I'm conscious about buying properties in good neighborhoods. So one of the things that I do is I also do the voucher program. DC has a decent voucher program. And the reason why I do that is because when I was in New York, at Virginia State, I was around the same people. So the intent here is to get these people who are in the voucher program, and I'm not saying it's all of them, but get people who are in the voucher program into a different environment where they can get a different perspective.
Can you just briefly explain what the voucher program is, just in case, you know, there are people listening that have no idea what that is?
Yeah, so the voucher program are people who are, in layman terms, you would say Section 8. People who are in Section 8, they aren't necessarily, they may not have done anything wrong and just in a bad situation, and they're trying to figure out how to get their get out of that situation. So what happens is that the government provides them a voucher that pays for their housing. And the people that I've experienced from Section 8, they're just well-to-do people for the most part who are just trying to figure out, how do I get out of this situation? How do I get on my own so that I can then be self-sufficient?
Right.
But when I have a building, I make sure that there's a Section 8 tenant in there for two reasons. The first is that it's helping them, because it's in a good neighborhood, and then they're also around people of different demographics.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the second thing is the government is going to pay the rent on time. Mm-hmm. So without fail, you know that you're going to get your money unless there's something that you did wrong.
Absolutely.
And need to address.
Absolutely.
So then I've also incorporated like an Airbnb structure into that business model, as well as renting to everyday people. And the most important part of that is that whether it's Section 8 or it's a everyday renter, you got to make sure that you screen the fuck out of these people, man. Because they will fuck your shit up. And then, especially in D.C., where it's a tenant-friendly district,
yeah,
you know, people can be in your spot for a year plus, and you're unable to get them out and while you're still paying the mortgage.
That's wild.
So, all my tenants, I make sure that I know them personally, right? We have conversations all the time and just find out what's going on with them.
Yeah.
Like, how can I help you? That type of thing. How can I help you without being too invasive?
Yeah. Have you ever had a situation where you, and it just popped in my head, you know, given tenant-friendly laws that are in D.C., ever had a situation where you get a tenant and you say, okay, the rent is $2,000 a month, and then they can afford it down the line, and you're like, okay, give me $1,000 a month, just so we can, you know, at least be moving forward with this instead of not paying me anything?
Yeah, I mean, as a currently a small-time landlord, if somebody's unable to pay, I got to figure out how to come up with that money. Right? I got to make sure that I have reserves in place in order to cover whatever shortfall it is.
Yeah.
So there's been several tenants that I've had where there's one specifically that I can think of that was on this. I didn't realize, again, the property management company, they put somebody in there that was on a short-term voucher program. I thought it was a long-term voucher program.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently it's just getting the people stabilized for the first 2 months. And then after that, they're pretty much on their own. So this person, they weren't bad tenants. Over time, they started to have some troubles. And I came up with payment plans, referred them to different organizations that they can reach out to who can help. But there's only a certain amount of time where you can reach out to these organizations in order to help you. There's a cap. So after that, you got to figure out like how you're going to move forward.
Interesting.
So yeah, there's been many of those.
And then, solutions.
And every time things like that happen, it's just like, okay, like you got to be able to refine the screening process so that you can see things like this coming and try to prepare yourself as best as possible. Or better yet, avoid it. Avoid it.
Easy peasy.
Yeah.
If you don't got to deal with it, you ain't got to deal with it. You know, just talking about all this, two questions. First, you know, you're growing, you're looking at expanding. Do you, or have you thought about hiring someone to help you with the planning or, you know, the screening process or just taking care of the apartments down the line? And then secondly, I mean, you have so much knowledge about this. You've been doing this for the last 10, 15 years. Maybe organize a seminar or class where you can actually pass down some of this knowledge. Because I'd love, I mean, I know we talk, but I'd really, you know, want to know more. And I'm sure that people out there would want to know more as well about how you can, like, just the model you've created for yourself that's sustainable and that you're doing. Like, how can you share that information to other Black men, or they don't even have to, to people out there, basically?
Yeah, I've been thinking about scaling a lot. And I think last year, I was really trying to figure out how to do it quickly, right? Because last year was the first year I was on my own.
Mm.
And I planted a lot of seeds last year that are coming to fruition this year. And what I came to realize is like, I had to slow down a little. When it comes to property management, I'm a huge believer in, the crazy thing about property management is it's the most important job in being a real estate owner.
Mm.
But it's the most thankless job.
You said thankless?
Thankless.
Thankless. Mm.
That these people, they aren't paid that well and they're not treated that well. And plus what they have to deal with on a daily basis. So eventually I do want to get to the point where I am screening. I'm handing it off to someone. But the step would be I'm going to hand it off to someone once my portfolio gets to that point, but I'm always going to be involved. I'm always going to want to see everything.
Absolutely.
Everybody that's going into the unit, I want to see what their screening look like so that I can make that final decision. And then once we of the same mindset on who comes in, then I'll say I'll be more comfortable with letting it go. But I can't necessarily say that I'll ever be that comfortable. Hence why I'm saying eventually I get to the point where I have a property management company.
Yeah, makes sense.
Then to answer your other question, yeah, it's so much information that you pick up over time and that you're also learning as you go. It's not a bad idea to start to maybe have seminars, like you say, so that you can teach a class, field some questions, give feedback. It just sounds very time consuming. So one of the things that I'm completely fine with giving people information, right? If people can reach out and ask me anything, I'm going to give you more information than you probably asked for. But a lot of times what you find is there's some people who they want to say that they're interested in the information, but then they don't take any action on the information.
Yeah.
So I'd rather have a more genuine conversation with people. Hey, I'm interested in buying a property, because a lot of times it's a lot simpler than you know. Maybe one day I'll get to the point where I will do a seminar, but I'm just not there yet. Right now, I'm so focused on scaling.
I hear you. I hear you. I feel you. Well, I mean, it's been wonderful having you come here and, you know, getting to know you more and your story. You know, all the way from Jamaica, moved to New York, and then the DMV area. What's the biggest lesson you've learned so far in life? And, you know, just to close, what advice would you give to people out there listening?
It's one and the same. The biggest lesson I've learned is continue to create relationships, meaningful relationships. I'm not talking about networking. I'm talking about actually getting to know people that you're interested in and that who have a genuine interest in you.
That's a good one.
And that's also the biggest lesson and the biggest advice I'll give to anyone.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And you'll always know, you know, you'll always know from the jump when you're having a conversation.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast, Gareth. I'm glad we finally got to do this. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you having me.